Washington State today reported the nation's first death from the coronavirus.
That was February 29th, 2020.
This weekend, we mark the million more people in the U.S. who have followed. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
And I'm Scott Simon, and this is Up First from NPR News. That man in Washington State was just the first person we knew at the time to have died of COVID-19 in the U.S. This weekend's milestone comes as the coronavirus mounts yet another surge, fueled by an Omicron subvariant. We have the latest.
In Kyiv, prosecuting war crimes while Russia pummels Ukraine's east, we've got the details on the first case. And we go to Chicago, where supporters of abortion rights are assembling.
So please stay with us. We have the news you need to start your weekend.
As the country approaches the staggering statistic, a million people in the U.S. killed by COVID-19, the virus continues.
And it's surging yet again in the United States, threatening to add even more loss of life to that enormous toll. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein joins us. Rob, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
And yet, another surge. Again, we hear, just to emphasize the point of how terribly costly this pandemic has already been.
Yes, Scott, unfortunately, it's true. The number of people catching the virus has been rising again now for weeks, and the number of true infections is probably way higher than the official numbers since so many people are testing themselves at home or, you know, not testing at all. Just think about it, Scott. Doesn't it seem like everyone around you is catching COVID these days?
Well, a lot of people, yes.
I talked about this with Dr. David Dowdy. He's an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins.
The number of cases has almost tripled since the end of March. Over the past 2 weeks, on average, we've seen about a 50% increase in the number of reported cases. That's north, south, east, and west. So we're in the midst, honestly, of a surge of cases.
And it's not just infections that are surging. The number of people getting so sick that they're ending up in a hospital is rising again, too. And the number of people dying every day has stopped falling. It's plateaued after steadily falling for months and may even be starting to rise again, especially in some parts of the country.
Why is this happening, Rob?
You know, Scott, it's a combination of factors. One is that an even more contagious Omicron subvariant that's even better at sneaking around the immune system is taking over. At the same time, the protection people got from getting vaccinated is wearing off, and people are just being less careful, you know, not wearing masks, traveling more. Here's Dr. David Rubin at the Policy Lab in Philadelphia.
It wasn't just the traveling around the holidays and spring break, but it was also the ending of the transit mandates. And I think subsequently, I think we've seen a lot of return of springtime large gatherings, not the smaller gatherings, but, you know, proms, you know, parties, sporting events, et cetera, that are now fully unmasked.
Letting this incredibly contagious Omicron subvariant spread like crazy.
Rob, how bad do you think it's going to get?
Well, Scott, no one really knows for sure, but the hope is it could be fairly modest compared to previous surges and short-lived because the immunity people still have from so many people catching Omicron this winter and from all the people who have gotten vaccinated. Here's Lauren Ansel Myers at the University of Texas at Austin.
Our projections suggest that we're in the middle of a small surge, you know, something that looks more like a bump rather than a mountain.
That could subside by the end of the month. And, you know, so even the people who are being hospitalized don't seem to be getting as sick as in previous surges. You know, fewer people are requiring oxygen or intensive care, for example. So the hope is that even if lots of people catch the virus, hospitals won't get overwhelmed again and deaths won't shoot back up big time.
What about this summer and next fall, next winter for that matter?
Well, you know, it's possible there will be another surge this summer, especially in the South, like in the last two summers. And the experts are really worried about the fall and winter when they do expect yet another big wave, because immunity will have waned even more by then, and people will be heading back inside because of the colder weather. So the federal government is gearing up for another big vaccine campaign this fall and scrambling to figure out which new version of the vaccine would make the most sense for people to get to try to minimize how much more of a toll the pandemic will take.
NPR health correspondent Rob Stein. Rob, thanks so much.
Sure thing, Scott.
Ukraine has launched its first prosecution for war crimes against a 21-year-old sergeant in the Russian army.
Prosecutors say this is just one of many such cases they expect to file against Russian troops in the days ahead. NPR's Greg Myrie is in Lviv, Ukraine, and joins us now. Greg, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Aisha.
So, what are the details of this first case?
Well, this Russian soldier is Sergeant Vadim Shishimarin, and Ukrainian prosecutors say that just 4 days into the war, on February 28th, he was with a group of fellow soldiers in a village tucked away in the northeastern corner of Ukraine. Several of them allegedly stole a Ukrainian car at gunpoint, and as they were leaving, they saw an unarmed Ukrainian man on the side of the road. He was 62 years old. He was walking his bike, talking on his phone. The Russians apparently thought he might be telling someone, perhaps Ukrainian troops, that the Russian troops were in the area. So one of the Russians allegedly told Sergeant Shishimarin to shoot the man, which he did, and killed him instantly.
So how did the Ukrainians identify this Russian sergeant and, you know, link him to the shooting and capture him?
Yeah, these are all good questions. We don't know the answers, and we'll be watching very closely at the trial. The sergeant was clearly captured at some point. He appeared in court in the capital Kyiv on Friday. He was seated in a glass box. He was handcuffed. He had a blue and gray hoodie. His head was shaved. He kept his head down the whole time, didn't say anything when journalists tried to ask him questions. Now, he has a court-appointed lawyer who is Ukrainian. The lawyer says he wants to protect the rights of his client and show that, as he said, quote, that we are a country different from the one he's from. Now, broadly speaking, there's overwhelming evidence that Russian troops have committed atrocities. Still, Ukrainian prosecutors will be expected to show that this Russian sergeant committed this particular shooting, and his case resumes on Wednesday.
Ukrainian prosecutors say this case is just the beginning. What does that mean?
Well, they say many more are coming. They've identified what they say are more than 10,000 suspected war crimes. They're working with international investigators to gather evidence as quickly as possible. Now, for example, Ukraine has named suspects in the Russian military for atrocities in Bucha. That's a suburb of Kyiv where many civilians were killed. But as far as we know, none of the suspects have been captured. And that really looks to be the major challenge in many of these cases. But overall, Ukraine's prosecutor general says the country is currently preparing 41 cases and expects many more.
Ukrainians are clearly moving and want to move fast to try these war crimes. But how unusual is it to actually be carrying out war crimes trials during the war? Like, the war is still going on.
Yeah, it's very unusual. The basic model was established after World War II when Nazis were tried at Nuremberg shortly after the war. These court proceedings were run by the victorious nations, including the Soviet Union, we should note, and it focused on top-level Nazi figures. But Ukraine says that waiting to prosecute cases after a war poses all sorts of challenges. It's hard to gather evidence, track down witnesses. So Ukraine says one reason it wants to start prosecutions now is to show Russian soldiers currently fighting in Ukraine that there's a real possibility they could be put on trial if they commit war crimes.
That's NPR's Greg Myrie in Lviv, Ukraine. Greg, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We're watching rallies today as the U.S. Supreme Court continues to work its way toward what looks to be either a substantial weakening of national abortion rights protections or fully overturning Roe v. Wade.
Abortion rights supporters are gathering in New York, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and in Chicago, where NPR's Cheryl Corley is based, and she joins us now. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
You know, as we said, the Supreme Court hasn't made any decision yet, but people are reacting, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Aisha, there's always been this expectation that if there was a conservative majority on the court, that the law was at risk. And that leaked document seems to indicate that may be likely. So abortion rights supporters say they want abortions to continue to be accessible. They want them to be safe. And they want to be the ones to make the decision about whether or not to have an abortion, not the government. So they have this day of action, which they are calling bans off our bodies.
So what do organizers, you know, hope to get from these marches?
Well, I think in part it's to let lawmakers and the Supreme Court know that there are just hundreds of thousands of people, women and men, who support Roe v. Wade. And it's also an effort to have some sort of influence over state lawmakers who may end up deciding if abortion will remain legal in their state. Rachel Carmona is the executive director of Women March, one of the organizers of the marches.
Our role is to try to make our voices heard. And we know that we need to build political power. We need to build electoral power, but we also need to build community power. And so these mobilizations are trying to do just that.
If the court overturns Roe v. Wade, states will determine abortion access. What will that look like?
Well, in many areas, people just won't be able to have an abortion. There are 26 states that are poised to limit or ban access to the procedure. That means states where abortion will remain legal, like Illinois or California, that they're preparing for an influx of patients. You know, I visited one Planned Parenthood facility in Illinois right near the border of Indiana. And they increase surgery days from 1 to 2 days a week. The president of Planned Parenthood in Illinois, Jennifer Welch, says they've been preparing, building that facility near Indiana, another near Wisconsin. They did that in recent years. And they just finished expanding their downtown Chicago location. And Welch says Illinois is just going to be a haven in the Midwest, the only place for miles where people will be able to receive an abortion.
There may be no abortion access in between Illinois and Colorado. So patients could be coming to us from a number of states, a large swath of the Midwest and the Great Plains, and that's what we are preparing for.
And she says that could mean an extra 20 to 30,000 more patients in Illinois.
So the marches today were sponsored by Planned Parenthood and several other groups that support abortion rights. What are you hearing from opponents of abortion rights this weekend?
Well, they are cautiously happy and still determined to fight. I spoke earlier with an opponent, Eric Scheidler, president of the Pro-Life Action League based here in Illinois. And he says while he welcomes what could be in store for Roe v. Wade, abortion regardless will be legal in Illinois. So opponents here will still be on the defense.
We want to protect our rights to be outside of abortion facilities offering compassionate help. And we want to prevent any additional erosion of conscience rights for medical practitioners and the like.
And it's almost guaranteed that the fight over abortion won't end once the Supreme Court issues its ruling this summer. So today, supporters are just out in force across the country in an effort to preserve abortion access.
That's NPR's Cheryl Corley in Chicago. Cheryl, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
And that's Up First for Saturday, May 14th, 2022. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Aisha Roscoe. Tomorrow on the podcast, how a diversity plan sparked a fight in one of the most diverse places in the world. Follow us on social media. We're at Up First on Twitter.
And for more on Ukraine, the pandemic, the future of Roe, and also books and music, movies and sports, you can turn on the radio and listen to Weekend Edition every Saturday and Sunday morning. You can find your NPR station at stations.npr.org.